And we will, as we come to a theological area, we will refer to it, say a word or two, and pass on, and then come back and go into the theological innards, as it were, of the movement, which is over one century old. But before we start the history, we have got to ask ourselves, what is the ecumenical movement? What's it all about? To understand what the ecumenical movement means, I suppose we ought to ask ourselves what ecumenical means. Now, the word ecumenical roughly corresponds to oikumene. Which means, literally, universal. The one use that we have of the term in the Bible, in the New Testament, is the famous passage in which Jesus is speaking of the sinful woman, who, remember, having poured the alabaster jar of ointment over the feet of Christ, and she was rebuked by the disciples, especially by Judas. And then Christ said that this work that she has done in my favor will be said of her wherever the gospel will be preached. So throughout the world, wherever the gospel will be preached, this which she has done for me will be spoken of her. And the term, throughout the world, wherever the gospel will be preached, is oikumene in the Greek. That's the earliest scripture use in the New Testament we have of what is the root idea behind ecumenical. In the early church, the word ecumenical, or oikumene, referred to the church itself. And it was pretty much synonymous with Catholicos, meaning Catholic. About the only difference, at least in the early Christian use, between Catholic and ecumenical was that the word Catholic referred rather to, you might say, the people living out there throughout the world, or throughout the then civilized world, whereas ecumenical referred rather to, well, the church's activity in terms of, say, her bishops, of the hierarchy, of the faith. Until finally, by the time of the 4th century, with the first general council of the church, the Council of Nicaea in 325, by that time, and of course it couldn't come earlier, the word ecumenical was made to refer to a general council in which all the bishops met in solemn session. From then on, in the Catholic Church, in the Roman Catholic Church, the word ecumenical had been pretty much reserved either to the councils themselves, of which there have been 21, including the present, or to their teachings, or you might say to the faith, which somehow depends upon the definitions of those general councils. The Catholic faith, therefore, could be said and was spoken of as ecumenical. Why? Because it depended upon the teachings of ecumenical councils. Now, one thing that you want to see immediately before we study the modern use of the word ecumenical, which is somewhat different. You see all along the line, the word ecumenical, as used traditionally up to modern times, described a given, described something which was somehow in existence, either of the hierarchy as meeting in general session, or of the faith which they taught and defined, or of the church, which is a consequence of the teachings of these councils, was said to be ecumenical because it was universally united. Now that last touch is important. running through this whole idea of ecumenical, we're still on the Roman Catholic side, was of something which was indeed universal, but which was universal precisely because it was united. You see, the word universal is ambivalent. In itself, it simply means, well, spread out. Well, you can spread out a lot of things. But universal in the sense of ecumenical means spread out indeed, but united in its universality, in its being spread out. And the source of that unity, or if you will, ecumenicity, was the common faith that was taught by the ecumenical councils. But always it's a given. Always there is a unity already existing. Already there is a body which is there, which exists, and of which united body the general councils are the expression, and the faith which these councils teach is, well, the living out. So much to the Reformation. From the Reformation on, there are scattered references, and they're very scattered, to a new use of the word ecumenical as found in the early scholastic divines in the late 16th and 17th centuries. They are now speaking of the need for uniting, if you will, reuniting a church which by that time had become quite fragmented. And they are, while very sporadically, it's not a movement yet, but they're at least speaking of some kind of ecumenicity now, which looks to unite what quite obviously was not united. Now, from the very beginning, let's drop the word for a moment, from the very beginning of the Reformation era, you have already the famous formula of Concord, which I think is 1577, or the Book of Concord, which included much more than the formula, I believe in 1584. Now, the word Concord, the very fact that a term like that would have been coined, suggests that desire to somehow unite those which by that time had been disunited. This is, of course, among the Protestants, mainly between the evangelical and the Reformed creeds, as we saw in going through this whole business. In fact, unless we had spent 4 weeks on what we did, the ecumenical movement would have been quite meaningless. We'd ask ourselves, well, why bother? Why don't they get together? Why don't they get together? See? Just to see the variety, you see, of profound theological divergences, first as between Catholicism and Protestantism, then within the traditions of Protestantism itself, you see? In other words, there's something to ecumenize once you know the background. There have been, or had been, sporadic movements, even movements, to reunite a disunited Christianity before the 19th century. In fact, we might say within a generation, less in fact, of the Reformation's beginnings, there were already efforts, strong efforts, to unite. Periodically, those efforts at union were strongly sanctioned by political power. And in fact, the separatist movement, or what shall we call it? In a sense, our own American colonies, at least on their Anglo-Saxon side, are the fruit of an abortive ecumenical movement pressured by political power. And we begin to see how unripe the ecumenical movement was with these people fleeing for their lives, literally. And they were both Catholics, as we know, and Protestants. The nonconformists, the separatists, and of course the terms you may be sure were coined by those who resisted political unification, who didn't want to be united under a common couldn't be a common creed because they didn't believe the same thing, but some kind of a common political hegemony. So this thing had been going on, and to me the great marvel of the ecumenical movement is not that efforts at unity hadn't been made before, because they had, but that those efforts began from the inside. And it could be, this is rereading history, trying to think the, you might say, the faults of God after him, but it could well be that if there hadn't been those political efforts, where, as a matter of fact, state churches had been organized with terrific power behind them, where either you conformed or you died, if those efforts hadn't been made, if more, you might say, of the freedom of the human spirit had been recognized, that perhaps the ecumenical movement might have started back already in the late 16th century. But it didn't. And in the effort to do something about the dismemberment in the Christian world under duress at the cost, as we know, of much bloodshed, wars and whatnot, those differences had been crystallized, had been nationalized, had been politicized, had become part of the structure of a whole culture. See? This is rereading history, see? And we don't know what might have happened. At any rate, by the middle of the 19th century, we have the beginnings of the ecumenical movement as it is now understood. What is the meaning of the ecumenical movement as described in literature of those who began the ecumenical movement as we now understand it? I quote from Vissertoft. Vissertoft, I always have to look up the spelling to make sure that I have it accurate. So, Vissertoft, and this is either small or a capital, and this is small, if this is large, if that's large. So, Vissertoft, there's a break here, there's a break here, there's an apostrophe in front, apostrophe in front. I think you recognize the language from which it's derived, which is not common to most people in this audience. Vissertoft is the executive secretary of the World Council of Churches, the world's greatest authority on the ecumenical movement. In a sense, he synthesizes that movement in himself. He has spent a lifetime dedicated to that purpose, and his writings on the subject are highly respected. He has written a book on the meaning of ecumenical. Vissertoft, The Meaning of Ecumenical, London, 1954. I'd commend that little booklet to all of you. In fact, it's indispensable, I think, for an understanding of the theology of the ecumenical movement. The Meaning of Ecumenical by Vissertoft, London, 1954. It's been translated into all modern languages. Small thing, sells for about 50 cents. Ecumenical, I'm here quoting Vissertoft, he is interpreted in a substantial and spiritual, and the word spiritual is important, rather than in a formal and spatial manner. So, what in other words is ecumenical in the ecumenical movement? On the authority of the one who is the best to know about it. It is not a spatial universality, and less still a spatial unity, which of course is the definition still of Roman Catholicism, which quite equates ecumenical and Catholic. Equates it pretty much as you would equate the source or cause of something with the effect produced. Ecumenical being, say, as found in the councils, as found in their teachings, see, is a sort of the Catholicity. But he says, ecumenical does not mean a spatial universality or unity. It rather means a spiritual thing. Now here is the most important. Where the point of reference, I'm quoting Visakou, is not the secular oikumene. Now by secular oikumene, he doesn't mean secular in any bad sense. The worldwide oikumene, see? Already existing, but the church universal still to be established. And that, you'll see more as we go along, is enough, I think, for the present. Ecumenical, therefore, describes unity, all right. It also describes universality. But it looks over the existing separateness of Christianity and seeks to achieve what, on its premises, does not yet exist. Because clearly, Christians are not united. Yeah, therefore, instead of describing something existing, rather hopefully describes that which is looked forward to. And therefore, it is a movement. It is not an existing fact. The ecumenical movement is a fact. But the movement itself is a process. Its direction is unity. Its hope, of course, is to universalize that unity. It begins and speaks of and describes Christians as disunited. Now, behind it lies a premise, before we go any further, so as to make sense of what we're going to talk about in the historical structure. Behind it is a premise that is a valid one for both sides. I mean, both those who recognize or believe that the church exists, and for those who still look forward to the church coming into existence. And that is that in the process of becoming united, there is already something which somehow they have in common. Because you don't unite anything except in terms of something which unites them. See? There is some common denominator which it is hoped all Christians will somehow come to share. It's based on a hypothesis. The hypothesis being that there is something which already they are somehow sharing, and if only they could completely share it, they would indeed be united. So much for the, you might say, the background of the term ecumenical, and now the actual history. Now for me, when I speak or write about the ecumenical movement, I like to think of it as concretized in something definite. See, movement is an amorphous thing. And you feel uncomfortable, at least I do, in talking about movements. Because unless you define your terms very carefully, you go in all directions, and that means you're going in no single direction, and after a while you're almost contradicting yourself. I like to identify the ecumenical movement with the World Council of Churches. It doesn't mean that all ecumenical movement is within the World Council of Churches. No. But that the history of the ecumenical movement is best described in the history of the World Council of Churches. The background of the World Council is the background of the modern ecumenical movement. The most powerful single force in the world for ecumenism is the World Council. And even those who don't belong to the World Council, as say many Protestants, and of course the Roman Catholic Church, nevertheless, contend with and are to be compared with the World Council insofar as they are ecumenical. In other words, the pace has been set by the World Council to describe modern ecumenism, which, by the way, is the only kind that can be spoken of as a movement. Where does it begin? Now, there are certain dates that simply must be known, and they are the pegs on which you hang the ecumenical movement in modern times. Actually, every year, for over 100 years, has some ecumenical significance. Well, for those of you that are interested, that, by the way, is a very convenient way of teaching the ecumenical movement. A course, college, that is going to give a semester course on the ecumenical movement this coming year has asked me to draw up some kind of a syllabus, and I will suggest to them to use the historical structure. Okay. Big dates, then you've got certain people, certain documents, and you teach it as a piece of history. Very interesting, and yet you know where you're starting, you know where you end, and the thing is still going up. The beginning date I would put down as 1844. Now, there is so much written on the ecumenical movement that you've got, as you can imagine, a lot of opinions. It's like, when does the Renaissance begin? When do the Middle Ages begin? Well, it all depends on what are the other sides of the middle. And everybody has his own extremes, consequently. So with the ecumenical movement, when does it begin? Well, I think it begins, and I'm not the only one, in 1844. With what? Do I have enough room for the dates? I'll have to go a little higher. Is the foundation, the beginnings of the Young Men's Christian Association, the YMCA. That is certainly the beginning of the best thinking along ecumenical lines, and I think is the historic inception. In 1844, the exact date is June the 6th. The YMCA was founded by a man by the name of George Williams, a Congregationalist, which, by the way, is significant if you remember what we said about free church theology. And it grew out of meetings for prayer and Bible study that Williams held among his fellow workers in a London dry goods establishment. There had been similar movements, as you can imagine, over the years. John Wesley had pretty much the same idea. Well, he started a church. Williams started something else. The difference between Williams and anybody else who had the same idea was that Williams was not, you might say, theologically bound, which was negative, but positively, he was a man of broad vision, and his idea was to somehow unite those who indeed had different denominational positions in some kind of common, well, eventually profession of faith, but at least proximately in some kind of cooperative Christian effort, hence the name. It was an association of Christian men who were fairly young, although if you saw the ages of some of them, you wondered why they called themselves young men, and then later on, of course, younger. In less than 5 years, the association had spread to half a dozen countries in Europe and America. By 1855, meaning in less than a generation, in 11 years, to indicate that this answered a need, see? They held their first world conference in Paris. That's 1855. With delegates from 10 nations. One reason, of course, for the very rapid diffusion was British colonialism. Most of them, of course, were from the British Commonwealth, but also in France. It was in Paris in 1855 that the constitutions, I'm quoting from my own writing on the subject, so I feel I'm not plagiarizing. In 1855, when the constitutions of the YMCA were framed, The principles were laid down, which have never departed from the YMCA, and which was, by the time what we now call the ecumenical movement, which has all kinds of theological sophistication, see, the Spirit had already been born. See? And just listen to this. This is the purpose, as set out in the constitutions of the YMCA, which have never been changed. It is our deep and earnest conviction that it is a duty of Christians to aim at the restoration of the unity of the Church. 1855, from the Paris translation from the French. We may be asked, I'm still quoting from the constitutions, but how is the unity of the Church to be restored? Then they ask, by reciprocal and enervating concessions, as in Prussia, where they have been forced to unite the various churches under duress? We answer, never. But by agreement resulting from our common progress. Watch that word agreement. It is the same concept as the word covenant that we met way back. Remember? Don't forget William's background. This is a lot to do, see? With a proper understanding of the ecumenical movement. Not to know this is not to know the ecumenical movement. Okay? It has gone way beyond this stage. Way beyond it. There's a lot of theology in it. But there's a spirit still there that must be known. But by agreement resulting from our common purpose. Notice the agreement. The agreement therefore comes among the people. Remember when we saw this whole business, the four levels of how the church is united? In terms of the free church polity, not by a common profession of a faith to which you subscribe, a confession which is outside of you, okay? But by agreement, by covenant. There is in each church, I'm still reading from the constitutions, there is in each church some truth, better understood by it than by others, and which often constitutes its strength. Our association, composed of members of each of these churches, naturally embodies all truths. That is the premise. Each one, striking his own note alone, produces discord. We wish to produce harmony by their proper combination. Let me repeat. This is more than a metaphor. Each one, striking his own note alone, produces discord. We wish to produce harmony by their proper combination. The next state, and you can see what we're dealing with. In other words, we are dealing with a spirit which, of course, is of the essence of the ecumenical movement. I would like to, before we go any further, just to assure you that we're dealing with something much more than a sporadic impulse. All the great leaders of the YMCA have been leaders in the World Council of Churches. Visser Tooft spent over 20 years with the YMCA as executive secretary before he became head of the World Council of Churches. John Mott, the giant behind World Ecumenical Movement, the founder, we can speak of one man, John R. Mott, M-O-T-T, one man as founder of the Ecumenical Movement, it would have been he. John Mott was the first international president of the YMCA. I want to stress that element to assure you we're not dealing with, you might say, just superficial relationships. The second date is 1895. This is the beginning of the WSCF, the World Student Christian Federation. The World Student Christian Federation. You'll notice in both cases, the Y, which by definition immediately caters to young people And here the world's student Christian Federation, again implying young people, see? There he is, and there has always been behind the ecumenical movement. You might say the initiative from the young people, see, to do something about this. And while, of course, not a few old-timers have got into it, it was assumed somewhat psychologically, and perhaps not inaccurately, that whatever changes are going to take place, either the youth change or nothing changes. Which, by the way, has a lot to do for us, myself, which, whether you realize it or not, was part of one of the 10 or so reasons why I came to Western Michigan, hoping that in some way with the youth, something can be done. The ecumenical movement will be as successful as the youth recognize and do something about it. Now, the World Students Christian Federation was founded by Mott, whom I mentioned before. Mott had been secretary of the YMCA from the age of 23 back in 1865. For 30 years, he had been first in office, then out of office, then back in office, but you might say the recognized head of the YMCA. Then he figured, and correctly, that the association, with its main concern along social lines, and this is not a study of the YMCA, that there should be something more intellectual. So he founded intellectual counterpart to the YMCA, which is the WSCF, of which I should add, all Protestant chaplaincies on all college campuses throughout the world are the immediate result. This was Mott's dream. So he was a broad visioned man. Now, he was the one who formulated the guiding charter of the World Federation. I want to quote from the constitutions of the World Student Christian Federation, again to see the ecumenical spirit behind it. Four purposes. Three. Can't see speak. First, to unite student Christian movements or organizations throughout the world. Second, to collect information regarding the religious conditions of the students of all lands. How are they doing? So, to find the need, then what is sheer genius? To fill it. Third, to promote the following lines of activity. : To lead students to become disciples of Jesus Christ as only Savior and as God. Notice the faith. This is a different kind of a man has entered the movement. To deepen the spiritual life of students. These are the lines of activity. To enlist students in the work of extending the kingdom of Christ throughout the whole world. Well, that's almost militant, isn't it, in its outlook? But notice, extend, whole world, unite, all lands. See? Those are synonyms for ecumenical. Now with that we have what we might call this the background of the ecumenical movement. You'll pardon this perpendicular pronoun, but one advantage that I tell my students when sometimes they get drowsy, sleepy, or don't see the reason for coming to class, I tell them one advantage of coming to class is that provided the man knows what he's talking about, you save yourself a lot of time. To summarize a whole movement, I can say literally there must be at least 300 volumes behind it. Just you save yourself a lot of time to know where this thing is going, and then, of course, I hope to fill it out. The actual beginnings of the modern ecumenical movement are in 1910. In other words, that is the background. You might say it is the preparation of the ground. It's the, the sowing of the seed, if you will. The ecumenical movement, on its theological side and as commonly understood in modern times, began in 1910 in Edinburgh at a meeting of the World Missionary Conference. World Missionary Conference. I put this conference because there was another one called Council that is going to be different. Now, don't get this wrong. 1910 does not mean that the conference was founded in 1910. No, it already existed. But for the first time in the history of this conference, which was a missionary conference of all the major Protestant missionary groups throughout the world, they would meet periodically every 8 or 10 years, depending on the needs, to study their common problems and policies. But in 1910, they came to a crossroads. They saw something radical has got to be done. What was the problem? The problem was division. Division among the various preachers of the gospel who were confusing the natives, who were conflicting with themselves, who were scandalizing everybody, and who were being very inefficient. In a word, they were not evangelizing. As a result of the conference, it was decided to set up a commission to study what might be done to get together. For what purpose? To make the propagation of the gospel more effective. It was a very pragmatic thing. And this is well to know. In other words, there's a pragmatism here. Here was a problem. They were out preaching the gospel. They didn't perhaps even realize. They may have come from 50 miles apart back in the home territory from Paducah, Kentucky, and found themselves in Zulu land preaching a different gospel. They decided this can't go on. So they appointed a committee headed by a man by the name of Brent. Charles Brent, who was a missionary, Episcopalian missionary to the Philippines, to study what could be done, and he was to be the chairman of the standing committee to study how they could resolve what? As much as possible in order to expedite the preaching of the gospel. Now, theirs was not a mere question of efficiency. The spur was efficiency. The object was to do something with their theology, or whatever you want to call it, with their faith. Okay? Let's get together. Either we're not teaching a different gospel, or we are. If we are not, let's find out why we use a different language. And if it's not just a difference of language, but a different gospel, in the name of the Christ that we commonly worship, let's preach one gospel. And we won't preach it until we believe it. You see? Very simple logic. This is the beginning of the ecumenical movement in modern times. It has never departed from that basic premise. Now, among the people, Brent continued with his work. And we're going to see in a moment where Brent comes in. But before his work bears fruit in the first meeting of the standing committee, something happened in the meantime, led by this same John Mott that had organized the Students World Federation. He was instrumental in helping to found the International Missionary Council. Now this we can put perhaps in red or whatever you want to call it, green. Let's make it green as a whole. 1921, the International Missionary. I notice this is Council. Why put this separate? because, and just to follow it, because this stream down here continued here in a movement quite distinct from this one. And it was only in 1961 in New Delhi at the third meeting, third World Assembly of the World Council of Churches, that this ecumenical movement united with this one. It's not just a big blotch to all kinds of distinctions here. So the International Missionary Council was founded in 1921 as, you might say, the answer to the immediate purpose which the missionaries had met in 1910, see, to do something about it. You might say, and this is speaking loosely, that in 1910, when the International or the World Missionary Conference, see, met, there were within the group or among the missionaries the activists and the theorists, those who said, let's do something, and the others who said, well, we can do something after we've thought this thing through. Well, thinking anything through takes a long time. That's why it was not until 1948, after 38 years, that the first fruits on the theoretical side bore fruit to form the World Council of Churches. The International Missionary Council, therefore, came into existence in 1921. It, you might say, operated pretty much on a status quo basis, where the missionaries decided to work together to avoid rasping differences in their preaching and teaching, and form some kind of a liaison that took 40 years exactly. From 1921 to 1961, see, before the IMC, which was practical, see, and solved its problems on a practical level, finally joined those who formed the World Council of Churches, who were the theologians, see, to form one big united body, where the IMC has been absorbed by the World Council of Churches, about which we will see when we take it. After we had our coffee. Stockholm. What is called a life and work. Division or section of the ecumenical movement. The term life and work is technical. It refers, life and work is a general term that refers to, you might say, the externals of the Christian faith on the social, economic, political, and such level, and not on the level of the faith or worship as such. So life and work comprehends all those aspects of Christianity which are not formally religious, but of course have profound religious implications, race questions, social problems, and so on. Now you see, always there is this desire for to do something, and then the thing has to break up because there are different aspects of it. Now the first meeting in Stockholm in 1925 of the Life and Work Conference, it is called, or Life and Work, was a meeting of something like 60 some denominations met, and that was, you might say, the first organized fruit of the beginnings of the ecumenical movement back in 1910. Because up to now, you see, the discussions and even the movements, such as the YMCA or others, had been, or even the International Missionary Council are pretty much among individuals. Now the real genius, and this is to me saying a lot, the real genius of the ecumenical movement and its success has been the recognition that you can work with churches, with denominations, with bodies. In other words, that there is enough homogeneity in a given denomination to work with it, that you don't just have a staff of experts, a group of people who somehow cut across various denominations and then hope that maybe out of this discussion some kind of unification will come. So the effort, just a moment, the effort behind the ecumenical movement from the beginning, from its inception, was along denominational lines. So that the ecumenical movement is, and may be described at this point, and even now, as the desire to reunite the dismembered Christian churches, Christian denominations. Don't lose that social element there, see? It's bodies trying to reunite with bodies, albeit, of course, through their authorized delegates. Mike?
If you're going to reunite on this basic level, doesn't that somehow imply the need for authority in the churches?
Yes, well, that is something which, in speaking, as I have, I remember giving a lecture in Louisville about 2 years ago on this, and I was challenged right and left. I think so. In fact, the moment you say denomination or church, now there may not be one single person, obviously, who is saying authority. Nevertheless, there is, isn't there, must be somehow, some kind of subscription to, well, to something which somehow unifies and distinguishes this denomination from another one. I think so. John?
Was there any single person or smaller group of people behind this life and work commission or whatever it was called?
Well, I would say it was John Mott. I would say if there was one single individual, it would be John Mott who was behind this.
You see, somebody or somebody has to originate something which has a title, at least this official.
Well, it was the World Missionary Conference. See, this is sequential. Here's the break. See?
All right.
Here's a break. Officials, individuals, especially Mott. See? Mott is the link between the background and, you might say, the movement itself. But this, that's why I wanted to put it here, see? This goes right down now. It's the World Missionary Conference. Within which you might say there were three, and you're not complicating these, I hope, three movements. The one which settled for the de facto, practical, living out of missionary work. And they formed the IMC. And as far as they were concerned, well, that's all they needed. Maybe they wanted more, but at least they were satisfied. But then the more theoretical, the more inquisitive and, you might say, sophisticated side of the ecumenical movement were those who, missionary work was only one small segment. They were concerned about the dismemberment of Christianity as such, and not only over one of its bad symptoms. See? Then they, in turn, subdivided, see, into those who wanted to study the underpinnings of dismemberment on things that were not formally theological, which they called life and work, because the roots of much denominationalism is linguistic, is cultural, is nationalistic, is a lot of things. And, of course, it's also theological. The one group, therefore, met at Stockholm, under denominational aegis, to study how they could get together along social, economic, and other lines, with a view, of course, to eventually even melting theological barriers. The second group, in 1927... And this, you will notice, is distinct. So we want to illustrate. What am I going to illustrate with? There is a twofold lineage. Now this, see what we're saying? This is the inception. the whole modern ecumenical movement can be traced back to that, both juridically and even personally. There was one group that worked on the mechanics of getting along among missionaries, and they formed a powerful body which went on its individual autonomous way and has since fused with the World Council of Churches. But it took 40 years for that to happen. Then two other bodies of more theoretical nature evolved: Light and Work and Faith and Order. So here is Lausanne, of which I think we have in our book. We have Lausanne in our book. Faith and Order, which is the complement to Life and Work. Dealing with what? Dealing with, as the words imply, faith, referring to belief, and order, referring to worship. Now let's just look, we won't examine now, this is not our business now, just look at what we've got in the author, so you know where we are, so you can put the things together. See? August 20th, 1927, Faith and Order Conference, see, Lausanne. And notice the first sentence: God wills unity. That is a theological premise. Now we'll, just to see it, it's very short, just a few paragraphs with many implications. Now we have, therefore, two movements simultaneously going on, parallel to one another, and yet they felt they could not go their several ways, and well, in their efforts to reunite Christianity, they formed another big division. So whatever we do, we've got to get together. So they decided, but it took time. Now, the ecumenical movement would have been 10 or more years in advance, in fact 20 years, had it not been for the two world wars. It was first stymied by the First World War, 1910, then shortly after came 1914. It was stymied a second time by meeting in 1937, where the two worked together. That is the Faith and Order, that is 1937. Faith and Order met at Edinburgh and the Life and Work met at Oxford. So that's 1937. In other words, they had got together deciding that we've got to fuse our two several movements. These both, by the way, are on the level of ideas. See? The practical thing was disposed of and they were getting along as well as they might. But the theory, which is still going on, see, was not fused because they met at the same time with a view to come to an agreement as to the next step. And they did at the next step in the following year, 1938. They met at Utrecht. And laid the foundations for the World Council of Churches. They didn't yet form the council. In other words, these two got together and decided we have got to cooperate under a common denominator. And the man who did that, the genius behind it, was Visser Tuft. Visser Tuft was the one appointed, say, chairman of the standing committee, which stood, as a matter of fact, for 10 years until the war was over. Stood around. And he, therefore, in his own person, you might say, synthesizes, say, the spirit of ecumenism. And to go back again, remember, it's Visser Tuft who spent upwards of 20 years with the YMCA. These are things that these lineages should be known. See? Anyhow. you address them is the beginnings of the World Council of Churches. Beginnings in that the council hadn't been formed, but the broad outlines were already spelled out. Then came the war, and everything came to a standstill, certainly anything theological. And therefore, it was not until 1948, and this 1948 then, is the birthday of the World Council of Churches. And then we have 1948, the World Council of Churches and its first assembly. So first World Assembly at Amsterdam. You will notice also, this is significant, that the moment they got really theological, they shifted onto the continent. See? Because up to this point, well, Lausanne is on the continent, but pretty much this had been a kind of English, Scottish, and American preoccupation. But the more they examine, the more they realize, well, this is no child's play. We've got to think this thing through, at which point they had to import the European theologians, and of course then it became, and ever since has been identified with continental theology. The present headquarters of the World Council of Churches are in Geneva, where I get my copy of the Ecumenical Review. World Council of Churches in Geneva. That's where the present headquarters are. So the first assembly was, World Assembly that is, was in Amsterdam in 1948. And the second was in 1954 at Evanston. Well, let's keep it consistent. In the United States. And the third, so far, 1961, was in New Delhi, India. Now, just a word about each. Then we can begin to study some of the structure of the World Council, and then we can go back into our respective theologizers. The first assembly of the World Council of Churches was, of course, a dramatic achievement. The men who participated were professional theologians. By that time, it was way beyond the practical stage, you see. A practical side had been taken care of pretty much by the International Missionary Council. These were men who were interested in disunity in the world, and the first statement of the Lausanne Conference, God wills unity, would, you might say, give a kind of a motto for their investigation. In Amsterdam, they worked out what has since become the Constitution of the World Council. And I want to read to you at least a bit from it. Has its standard book, contains all the essentials that the delegates attending the meeting would need. But the important thing is the Constitution. Well, Constitution, page 98. Always look at the index first. It covers only, this is well to know, 2-4 pages. Very short. Now, this is what Amsterdam did. Amsterdam, in other words, decided on a constitution which has been in operation since. It has been slightly modified, but not much. I'll read passages from the Constitution with a view to your getting what we're after, and then when we go back to examine the theological problems and development, you will see where we are. He was adopted in August 30th, 1948 in Amsterdam. First, the basis, very, very short, which suggests, you might say, the modesty of the reference. It reads only two sentences, two conditions for membership. The World Council of Churches is a fellowship of churches. The word fellowship, by the way, is, if you recall, a sacred term in the free church tradition. The World Council of Churches is a fellowship of churches. Notice that immediately, of churches. That's what's being worked at. And of course, the immediate question is, well, what is a church? Which accept our Lord Jesus Christ as God and Savior. And second basis, it is constituted for the discharge of the functions set out below. So there are two parts to the basis. Who constitutes it? All those churches, notice it's not people. Now this is highly significant, because any individual may quite deviate. It's the church which officially, now the question is, what does officially mean? Nevertheless, provided the church accepts our Lord Jesus Christ as God and Savior, then that church is eligible, albeit individual members may, as is obvious. There are very few churches that would require, as an absolute condition of membership, complete subscription to every last item of the creed of the respective confessions. This can be missed. It's the churches who, in their official statement, accept this, they then form the membership. There's no persons belong, no individual belongs to the World Council. Only bodies belong. Groups belong. It is only institutional membership. Hence the variety of theological opinion. Because it's people who have opinions. See? And secondly, its purpose is to discharge the function set out below. So it is both a fellowship and it is an organization with a purpose. And the purpose is spelled out below. The second part of the Constitution, I'll just, without going into details, there are nine sections. I think